Need your daily fix on mixed martial arts?
We're going to kind of recap Bellator 155.
From UFC 198.
Who's who.
Kind of a controversial decision.
And who's not.
I couldn't figure out why, and then it hit me.
Well, don't you fret, because Golden State Media Concepts got you covered. Get your daily dose of MMA podcasts. Everything from the UFC, Bellator Fighting Championships, Extreme Cage Fighting, Invicta Fighting Championships,
and so much more.
Join us as we talk about some of the biggest names in mixed martial arts. We've got you covered here on Golden State Media Concepts MMA Podcast.
All right, now, thank you for tuning in to the GSMC MMA podcast, brought to you by the GSMC Podcast Network. As usual, I am your host, and with me today is Sean. How are you doing there, Sean?
Doing great. Looking forward to talking about a lot of good fights that happened this weekend.
Excellent. We will be covering today, first thing we're going to be covering is that Conor McGregor could be press conference. We're going to talk about some John Jones news that just recently came out. John Jones is now eligible to fight. And then we're also going to talk about the announcement of the Valentina Shevchenko, Joanna Jędrzejczyk flyweight fight. We're going to talk a little bit about George St. Pierre. And then we're also going to cover the UFC Fight Night 137 in San Pablo. And then from there, we'll see how much time we have left, and we'll see what else we can add in. So, to start off, we're going to talk about that Conor McGregor, Khabib Nurmagomedov press conference. What was your thoughts on the press conference?
Well, quite frankly, I was really happy to see Conor McGregor finally back in the news for something MMA-related, where he's actually going to have a fight, not just throwing dollies at transportation.
Well, he's pretty good at throwing those dollies. I'm not even going to lie to you. He had that dolly went through that window quite impressively.
You know, like, I don't think most people realize dollies are quite heavy. Like that,
I
that's
know
a,
that. That's
keeping
what I
in
was,
shape.
I know it's wrong to say that, but dollies are super heavy, so... Yes, I was impressed by that. I know it's bad to talk about that. But this press conference, one of the things, up to this point, I was looking at things and I'm like, man, they have not really done a lot of press, a lot of things to promote this fight. And I was kind of worried that the fight would not have the excitement level that a fight like this deserved. But that press conference changed everything.
You know, I honestly think that in general, a Conor McGregor fight at this point, he's enough of an icon that has, you know, encaptured not only just the MMA world, but the sports world, that no matter what, there's going to be hype around a Conor McGregor fight. Whether you have six press conferences or two world tours like he did with Aldo, that's not necessary anymore. He creates his own hype, and people are always going to be wanting to know what's Conor McGregor up to. Especially with Khabib, which, you know, Russian monster... People have been waiting for this fight. I know I personally have been waiting for this fight for the good better part of 2 to 3 years.
Now, I'll tell you what. You are 100% right, because once this press conference started, it was all Conor McGregor, and it got you fired up and ready to go for this fight. First off, before we dive into some of the things that were said, how do you think... As a whole, what first off, before we go to that point, did you like the fact that there was it was just for the media, or do you think the fans should have been let in? I also like the fact that Conor made it very clear that he really wanted the fans there, not just the media.
Well, honestly, the Irish fans always bring it when it comes to spirit and a good time. You always see those videos of the MGM Grand lobby just being invaded by Irish fans in Las Vegas whenever it's fight week for Conor McGregor. I think it was probably a good idea, quite frankly, that the Russian fans and the Irish fans weren't put in the same small enclosed area, especially when they're both talking trash to each other.
Yeah,
that, so it's probably a liability issue.
I think that's what I think the UFC was kind of worried about, is putting in an arena bad enough that's going to be the event in October, but to have it kind of early was kind of a dangerous situation. Now, when I watched this press conference, I was in amaze. I was just absolutely amazed by Conor. Conor brought it. I don't think Khabib was ready for the heat that Conor McGregor put on him. I felt like he really bullied Khabib. I'd never seen Khabib kind of bullied before. Conor really just bullied Khabib a lot. What did you think?
Well, I mean, the whole reason we're talking about McGregor and the whole reason he's an icon of the sport is that he's one of a kind. And Khabib, before this, has always been very respectful, the consummate martial artist of I'm going to smash you and then beat you up until you give up. And all of his opponents before this have been very, you know, respectful and, you know, a little bit afraid because this monster from out east is going to come beat them up, and that's what's happened every time so far. But with McGregor, he's the legend killer. He's the guy that looked into Jose Aldo's eyes, screamed that he was going to kill him, and then knocked him out in 13 seconds. Killed the Aldo hype pretty quick, a guy who hadn't lost in 10 years. So, in essence, I think McGregor is the only type of guy that would, one, be willing to do that to Khabib, and two, that Khabib would be offset by due to the fact that, you know, Mystic Mac makes these things happen.
You know, I was watching this fight, and I've made no you know, bones about the fact that I personally think that Khabib was going to win this fight. And I've been leaning that way since before they were ever going to announce this fight. But when I was watching this, for the first time, I could see how Conor was getting in Khabib's head. And that's the thing that makes Conor so dangerous, is he gets fighters to get either emotional or get too much in there. They're going to show Conor what they're all about and make a mistake, and then Conor gets them. And I kind of felt like, you know what? Round one definitely went to Conor, and I truly felt like he was definitely in Khabib's head. There's a couple of times you could see Khabib just getting frustrated. And the other thing that shocked me was Conor wanted numerous times to get up and get in Khabib's face, and it seemed like Khabib wanted nothing to do with that. How did you see it?
Well, you know, Conor always brings it, but like you said, round one Conor, the fight when it comes to Conor McGregor starts now. It starts when they face each other and they're talking to the press.
And it's obvious that, yeah, yes.
Because when he is bringing that psychological warfare, much like an Ali or, you know, many other athletes of their eras, he gets inside their head. He's the type of guy that, you know, Khabib's worst enemy in a sense, that he's the type of guy they'll talk so much smack that he'll actually get Khabib to not go and stick to his game plan like Javier Mendez has been talking about, Khabib's head coach at AKA, of wrestling. I think he might talk enough smack to Khabib that Khabib's going to try to stand up to him. And quite frankly, that's the biggest risk of Khabib losing, is if Khabib gets outside of his own game plan and tries to stand with McGregor, much like we saw with the Iaquinta fight.
I agree with you. If Khabib goes away from what has gotten him to this point, and that is the wrestling and the ground and pound, and he tries to stand with Conor, it will be a very short night.
Oh,
but
yeah.
If Khabib sticks with his game plan, which I'm thinking this, the reason why I think I'm taking Khabib is the fact that he has a camp with a lot of seasoned professional fighters. Daniel Cormier, Cain Velasquez, Luke Rockhold. These guys have been champions. They've been in the biggest event. These are the guys that I think are going to calm Khabib down and get him on a game plan. Because if Conor isn't in his head and he wants to show that, hey, I can stop you and beat you in your own game, bad decision.
Well, at the end of the day, it's you versus one other person. Yes,
right,
you can get advice between rounds and, you know, get yourself in a new mindset. But there's that first round, which quite frankly, with Conor, especially at, you know, 145, 155, he can put people away inside of one round. And if he is able to get Khabib, which even for the first round, you know, if he's able to stuff takedowns of Khabib's, like, you know, a lot of people we've seen initially in the fight are able to stuff a couple of takedowns of Khabib's and land a couple of left straights, it could be a good night for Khabib. If Khabib's going to win this fight, it's going to be in the third round or later, and it's going to be because he's grinding Conor McGregor down. However, in for the first couple of rounds, especially if Khabib doesn't stick with his game plan and kind of just tries to show Conor, you know, a size comparison contest, so to speak, that he can stand with him as well. Again, short night for Khabib and a long night at the hospital for him.
Now, see, I look at this as no matter what, I don't really see this fight going past 2-3 rounds. And the reason why that is this. And this is kind of early. We'll get into breaking down the fight when we get a little closer to October 6th. But when I look at it and I see if Khabib is fighting his game plan and he's taking Conor down, that ground and pound is vicious. Also, if Conor runs into that situation where Conor tends to gas and then get a second tank, he tends to gas right around the middle or the end of the second round. That could be bad news for him. But when you shift it over to Khabib, I look at it as this. Early on, if Khabib is trying to stand, the kicks, the punches, Conor is super efficient, and Conor can stop you. I don't see this. Right now, this, like I said, this is the early prediction. I do not see Conor or Khabib going past the third round.
Now, that's where I disagree with you. Okay. Honestly, I think Khabib, and he's said this many times, he wants to punish Conor. He wants to punish him like you saw with Michael Johnson, like you saw, you know, even with Iaquinta, who, you know, most people would agree is not as good of a fighter as Conor.
No, it's not. Nowhere near.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just think the record shows, but I personally think that after all this smack talk and after the fact that, you know, everyone's going to be watching this fight, I think he wants, if everything goes right for Khabib, in his mind, I believe that he wants to put a 5-round smackdown on Conor and beat him up. I mean, maybe he gets a stoppage late in the fourth, you know, fifth. But I think in his perfect world, he gets to show everyone and make Conor look helpless. And I think that Conor, I mean, honestly, with his, you know, kicks, like you said, with his front leg side kick, as well as just, you know, calf kicks and whatnot, I think his best opportunity is keeping the distance with Khabib, making it hard for Khabib to find those openings for the takedowns. And when Khabib does go for that takedown, and, you know, you see it sometimes, Khabib just rushes at people. He rushes at people and tries to get those takedowns a couple of times in a row. You saw that with the Iaquinta fight. If Conor can get him to get desperate like that for those takedowns and rush in and make mistakes, that's Conor's chance.
You know, and one of the things, if, you know, you brought up the fact that Khabib had talked about wanting to punish Conor, that's fine in theory, but when you're actually in a fight, and I know you've competed as well, and I have competed, you come in with a game plan, you want to destroy someone. But the biggest thing you want is to get that win as quick as possible. And I just don't see him trying, even if he did have a chance to beat up on Conor, I don't see anyone being foolish enough to keep taking it into deeper and deeper water with the possibility of getting caught. It would just be not the smartest thing. Now, I'm going to change the subject right real quick because we're about to go to break. But one of the things that the UFC has done with this card, this is a fantastic card, but I love the fact that they put Tony Ferguson as the co-main event on this card. One, because if everything goes through, you know, it really does set up that Tony Ferguson gets the winner if he looks spectacular. But if for some reason another Dolly goes through a window, Khabib doesn't make weight, whatever it is, you have a situation where you have Tony Ferguson that can fill in. I think that was a really smart move because the UFC cannot afford to let this event not go through.
I think that was brilliant as well. You know, putting Tony Ferguson, one, keeping him busy, keeping him relevant still, you know, in terms of the spotlight by having him fight Anthony Pettis, who's looking a lot better now in his past couple fights.
Yes, I agree.
You know, Anthony Pettis looks like he might be on the verge of a, you know, second reemergence of his career. But
I say that's a little early to say that off of one win.
Yeah, off of one win, but if he beats Tony, then that's a whole other story.
You're right, that'd be a major feather in his cap
but
at that point.
Truthfully, even if let's say Conor wins, you know, hypothetically, I don't think Tony fights Conor, you know, Conor gets the belt. I don't think Tony fights Conor until at least late 2019, because quite frankly, at this point, Conor's making so much money and builds so much hype behind each fight, he doesn't need to fight more than once a year, if that.
Yeah, and I agree. Okay, on that, that's going to be our last take on this particular topic. When we come back, USADA has made a decision about John Jones.
Juicy boy.
Stay tuned, and we will be right back.
The average sedan is built with a steel frame and equipped with 6 airbags. Remember this the next time you see someone walking. Drivers, be aware. Pedestrians don't have armor. A message from the California Office of Traffic Safety. The average SUV has 2 blind spots, weighs between 4 and 6,000 pounds, and takes about 6 seconds to stop. Remember this the next time you're on foot. Pay attention, people. Pedestrians don't have armor. A message from the California Office of Traffic Safety.
All right, we're back, and in the first section, we just covered the Conor McGregor, Khabib Nurmagomedov. That's a lot harder to say than people realize.
Not as hard as Jędrzejczyk.
Actually, I think Joanna Jędrzejczyk is a lot easier. Khabib Nurmagomedov is a lot tougher, at least in my opinion.
Agree to disagree.
But when we were talking about that press conference, and just, I mean, you know, how impressive it was and how it really did get, it did serve its purpose of getting people fired up for the fight. Now we're going to talk about the other bit of news that came out in the last week or so. And that is USADA made an announcement that they had finally ruled on John Jones. First off, how long did it take for them to make this decision?
I think about 14 months.
Yeah, I was going to say over a year. And their decision was that John Jones is going to be suspended for 15 months time served. That means that John Jones is available to fight in November or October.
I think it's November, but I remember the last episode I was on. I think I called my shot there and said that this piece of news might come out soon.
Yes, I think we were all expecting that news to come out. USADA had a number of people within USADA had already kind of was coming out and kind of defending John Jones. I'm just surprised that that USADA went from John Jones facing a 4-year suspension for taking Trenibol to time served. And it sounds like, from what I was reading, that it's because John Jones came out and was super cooperative, and I guess he gave a lot of information about a lot of other people. That's just saying about...
There's a prison term for that.
Yeah, they were saying that he snitched, but I'm just saying he turned evidence to help his case. So he ended up with only 15 months. What was your thoughts when you saw that? As you know, as you said before, you weren't surprised, but were you surprised that really 15 months time served?
Quite frankly, no. I mean, at the end of the day, when you look at USADA, they have I was researching this a little bit, about 1/3 of their athlete testing of their business comes from the UFC and their major contract. So at the end of the day, when 1/3 of your business is on the line, you pretty much play to the tune of that customer. And if the UFC says, hey, we want this guy off a little earlier. Take it easy on this one. You know, it's a lot more likely for you to come to a more agreeable conclusion. Than...
See, and I'm not going to say that because I don't have enough information on
speculation.
Saying that.
That's
speculation. That's kind of your opinion there, but I do understand why you would say that, especially like when you have someone like Daniel Cormier who's kind of said USADA is kind of a joke. It does look kind of fishy, I must admit.
A lot of fighters have said USADA is a joke, quite frankly.
And, you know, so you look at this, and he's gotten off. I thought, you know, maybe they would give him like 2 years and say with time served so that maybe he's off for one more year. I thought maybe that's what they would do, but I didn't think they would just give him time served and he's back to fight in a month. That was a surprise.
Well, at the end of the day, whether you speculate or not, John Jones is the second biggest star of the UFC when it comes to numbers, when it comes to
without
height.
Question.
Without question. You know, back in the day.
Actually, third. I'm going to put GSP ahead of him.
Yeah, but at the same time, GSP's had one fight in the past five
yes,
years?
Yes, no, I agree. I understand
so
where you're coming from.
You're right. When GSP is fighting... Yes, he's the second biggest star. Of course,
obvious
Conor's
number one. Yes.
Yeah, number one. But back in the day, you had Brock, you had Ronda, you had GSP, and you had the emergence of Conor. But now you have Conor fighting maybe once a year. I mean, he did just sign a 6-fight deal, but
and
you know,
maybe every 2 years.
Yeah,
getting to the point. Yes,
but you know how the UFC does when they sign a 6-8-fight deal. A lot of the time, that's just to keep people under contract even
right.
after they retire. So at the end of the day. You have John Jones, and they need John Jones.
Absolutely.
So this doesn't surprise me, but it also doesn't surprise me with the timing because they always try to, at the end of the year, around November, they always try to have those big cards. Like, you know, they have them during July, and they have them November and December, especially at Madison Square Garden in November, as certain
now,
trends have shown.
Now, that's one of the things I was going to bring up to you, is that when Dana White was asked about this, they asked if he was going to be fighting at Madison Square Garden, and Dana White emphatically said, no, he won't be. Do you believe him?
I do not believe his lies. I'm sorry, it's an internet meme, but no, Dana White, you know, he has a tough job, because a lot of the time, especially in a hype business that he's in where he's promoting fights, he can't release information or he's unable to 100% verify information that people are speculating. So I think that John Jones is, if he's not fighting at Madison Square Garden, he's probably fighting at the end of December for the New Year's card. Something
okay.
He's going to get the premier card where people are hyped, no matter what.
Okay, I'm going to tell you this. This is one time I believe Dana White. And I know that's a shocker, right?
Oh, yeah.
I know you're looking at me like, wait a minute, what did you
yep.
just say? I believe Dana. I do not think he's going to be fighting on that MSG card. And strictly the reason why you don't want him to be on that MSG card is because I think the UFC wants to set up so that they have a situation where they have a blockbuster card to launch that new ESPN contract. I think they're going to do a blockbuster card at the beginning of the year, right at the beginning when they're starting they're consummating their new relationship with ESPN. Do not be shocked if you don't see Brock Lesnar versus Daniel Cormier and on the undercard, John Jones versus... Now, I'm going to jump ahead because I'm going to have you... There's a lot that you're going to jump in and hear on. But I say it's going to be John Jones versus Gustafsson, or my true dark horse is it's going to be John Jones versus Rumble Johnson as the co-main event, and the main event is Brock Lesnar, Daniel Cormier.
Well, the only way he fights Rumble Johnson is if they're at heavyweight, because have you seen pictures of that guy lately?
Well, and if you... There was a couple articles and a couple interviews where recently that Rumble has said he would be open to coming back and fighting. He's also talked about possibility of fighting at heavyweight.
Well,
all of that has been... is now on the table.
Well, I mean, he has to. If you've seen pictures of him, the guy looks like he weighs 265 pounds. Now, he's not fat by any means, but he's been hitting the gym, hitting those weights, and, you know, he's let's just say he hasn't been following the same diet he had to when he had to hit 170 once upon a time. So I could see John Jones fighting at heavyweight against Rumble, but I also think that ideally for the UFC, they would have that rematch versus Gustafsson because the first fight was so close. It was such a great fight. One of my favorite fights ever.
No, it's just one of the best fights of all time. But if I'm John Jones, I'm not doing that fight. And here's the reason why I'm not doing that fight. One, I've been off for a year and a half. Two, it is probably the most dangerous guy he can fight. And that fight does not move the needle. A fight that's going to move the needle would be him and Rumble, with the possibility of him fighting Cormier. If Cormier beat Brock Lesnar, a Cormier John Jones fight for the heavyweight title, and John Jones has already said he would love to see a two-fight situation between him and Cormier where he fights Cormier for the heavyweight title, wins that, and then goes and fights Cormier for the light heavyweight title and wins that. That's why I do believe Dana when I hear him say that they are not that John Jones is not going to be on the MSG card.
I don't think John Jones ever fights Daniel Cormier again at light heavyweight.
I'm saying that's the picture that they want to paint. But as far as Cormier, John Jones for the heavyweight title and setting that up for, think about the launch of the ESPN. You have that big main card with Brock Lesnar and Cormier. You mix in John Jones and let's say Rumble or Gustafsson. Then you turn around, if everything worked out for the UFC and for Daniel Cormier's very last fight ever, John Jones versus Daniel Cormier for the heavyweight title, that's called pay-per-view dollars.
Oh, no doubt. And that sounds like the beginning of a blockbuster movie. Like, I mean, you know, Daniel Cormier, the good dad with the tragedy early in his life, coming to win the heavyweight and light heavyweight title against this guy who, everyone would agree, no matter what your stance on him, has somewhat of a checkered past.
Yes,
and
I
then,
agree
you
on
know,
that.
If at the end Cormier was able to win that heavyweight fight against John Jones.
Oh, my goodness. Talk about riding off in the sunset.
I'd leave my gloves in the ring right there, go home, kiss the kids goodnight, and just be happy and go back to coaching wrestling for the rest of your life.
Yeah, if he pulled that off, he'd just run out of the ring. I wouldn't even have time to take my gloves off. Just run out of the ring just in case someone's going to change their mind. But, when you're looking at this, back to the USADA situation and going back to the fact that they've made this decision and they haven't suspended John Jones, Does this set a precedent where going forward, anyone that gets in trouble with USADA, it's just going to open the doors where it's just going to be like, what do you need to know? This is where I got the information. This is where I got everything at. And just, you know, tell everything and they're going to just get time served? What's going on here?
I think this shows that, one, just like when you're interacting with the cops, lawyer up. You know, when you're dealing with USADA, lawyer up. You know, don't say anything. Have your lawyer talk about everything. And perhaps you should purchase some supplements from Brazil and keep them in your kitchen cabinet just in case of emergency. But at the end of the day...
No, let's not make any speculation. That's not true.
No speculation. Right. I'm just saying there was the tainted supplement. That mm-hmm. was the official reason. So I think it really shows that, you know, a lot of fighters couldn't afford, or at least were unable to provide the same kind of defense John Jones was able to provide for himself.
All right, I'm going to jump in here, and I'm going to say I agree with you 100%. One of the problems that I have with the UFC and USADA is this. It's not equal. And what I mean by that is if you're a guy who's just coming into the UFC, maybe you've been struggling, you finally get your fight, and now you get popped with PEDs, you don't have the money for the lab testing and the lawyers and everything. And so you stand absolutely no chance. But if you're a fighter with very deep pockets and you can pay for multiple testing and you can pay for different labs and you can pay for you know, a law firm or multiple lawyers.
Expert witnesses.
And expert witnesses. you have a much better chance. Let's say Tonya Evringer coming over from, and actually Tonya is probably, she's been quite successful there, but let's say one of the Invicta fighters coming over, or one of the fighters from Glory or King of the Cage who's been fighting for a few hundred dollars or $1,000, they don't have the money for an expert witness. They don't have the money to go out and get their own lawyers. And it's kind of like the way our legal system is. If you're going to go with the appointed lawyer, you're doomed.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, even if you are a successful fighter in the UFC, a veteran, let's say you're making 70 to show, 70 to win.
Exactly.
You fight maybe 3 times a year. If you're lucky and you don't get injured, you fight 3 to 4 times a year. You know, after taxes, maybe, you know, depending where you are, maybe you have, you know, $200,000 left over. Are you really going to spend an arbitration process that may take a whole year?
Not to mention training camp, training, everything else. Yeah. You're not $200,000. You're probably closer to like
120, 130.
I was going to say 70 or 80, but I understand where you're coming from. You don't have that kind of money.
Yeah, and then, you know, a lot of the time you can't afford to go through 12 months of arbitration, lawyer fees alone, and you don't want to get a bad lawyer because then that's just throwing away money that you could have saved up for the time you're suspended.
And so, that's what I'm saying, the especially the fighter that's making 10 and 10 or 20 and 20.
That Reebok money, though.
Yes. It's rough for guys. It's just not a fair – it's not fair and balanced, and that's the one problem that I have with USADA. I personally think if you are Pop, I think it should be on a UFC dime and everyone is treated the same. USC uses their experts, the same lawyers, everyone gets a fair shake. It's just not I just don't think it's right.
Well, the UFC, if they were to provide those extra services, one, that would cost them a lot of money.
And UFC is not spending extra money.
They're a company. They're trying to make back that $4.2 billion they spent the ownership group spent to purchase. So, you know, with the ESPN deals and whatnot, they're trying to keep the money in and pay off. I mean, imagine the interest payments alone on a $4.2 billion acquisition. But the UFC, they have a lot of fighters that would love the chance to get in the UFC. The last thing they want to do is rack up millions upon millions of legal bills for fighters that, quite frankly, they might not see as worth the investment. You know, they had the new facility at the Performance Institute in Las Vegas. Yes, that does help the fighters. It's good PR, helps the fighters stay healthy on weight and, you know, figure out injuries. That's worth the investment for them. But is it really worth the investment if some prelim fighter goes through 12 months of arbitration and they've paid for a lawyer on, on just like $200,000 for a year's worth of services?
Yeah, I do understand where you're coming from. It's just that it's not a level playing field.
No, it's not.
It's definitely the world of haves and have not. That's the only thing I'm saying is that there's a lot of fighters that just don't have a fighting chance, and they're just going to accept it. If they get in trouble, they're just going to accept the suspension because they can't defend it.
Plus, the UFC wants to remain independent. Why would they be spending? Yes, they'd be funding both sides, because they're not only are they funding USADA and their testing protocol, but then they'd also be funding the lawyers. So that would be a very bad business plan for them. If, you know, one fighter's like, "No, I want to keep fighting it." The UFC has to try to remain as independent as possible, just for the PR alone, not only the business aspect.
I do agree with you on that. I understand where you're coming from with that. There has to be something done to make it more fair and balanced.
Let's start a GoFundMe.
Yeah. Well, with that, we're going to take another break. But when we come back, we're going to talk about a fight that was just announced. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
The average sedan is built with a steel frame and equipped with 6 airbags. Remember this the next time you see someone walking. Drivers, be aware. Pedestrians don't have armor. A message from the California Office of Traffic Safety.
All right, we're back. And what did we just cover?
We were just talking about the
John Jones,
that's right. Yeah, John Jones, and getting the very generous settlement by USADA.
Yes, John Jones, 15-month suspension, time served. So John Jones is eligible to fight as of October, November. So now we've covered that. We're also going to talk about an announcement that just came down the pike, and that is that for the UFC flyweight title, you are looking at Valentina Shevchenko versus my personal spirit animal, Joanna Jędrzejczyk.
Say that three times fast.
Joanna Jędrzejczyk.
Very good.
Nicely done. Okay, so what did you think when you saw that?
I was not surprised, but quite excited. I think these are the types of matchups that the UFC needs to make, especially when creating a new division. You know, especially considering what recently happened with the women's flyweight division, with the, you know, first inaugural title defense falling out when Montano missed weight, and or she didn't even show up. She pulled out.
Right? Yeah, she wasn't gonna make weight, and then she ended up going to the hospital and. It's just been a bad situation.
I think that's the embedded curse. She's shown buying food and being all nonchalant about her weight cut and the embeddeds, and then what happens? She misses weight and doesn't even show up to the weigh-ins.
Yes, and so, but honestly, I said this when they said that she was not going to be able to fight. I was hoping that they would put Joanna in as a fill-in and still make Shevchenko versus Joanna, but this is actually better. Both fighters will get a full camp. This is the third time. Actually, I think it's maybe they fought more. This is the third time.
Two times in Muay Thai.
Right. They fought twice in Muay Thai and Shevchenko won both.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And now, and in the UFC, it will be the first time they meet. I am super excited about this one because of this fight. It's a situation where their styles are so. It's really hard to figure out who's the better fighter here. When I look at it and I say Joanna's boxing game, Muay Thai game is second to none. But then when I look at Valentina Shevchenko and I look at her game, it's second to none. Valentina Shevchenko is super, just one of those tough, gritty women. Joanna's a tough, gritty lady. It's going to be a lot of stand up. How do you see this breaking down? Because I'm having a hard time breaking this fight down.
It's tough, but I think that the factor that goes into this fight, obviously, is that it's an MMA fight, not a Muay Thai fight.
I agree.
And with that, you know, it's been a while since they fought Muay Thai. And Joanna went to the lower weight division, where Shevchenko fought at 135 and even maybe at 145 at one point.
Only at 135.
Yeah, so you had people separated by two weight classes, and now they're coming together in the middle. I think what that really says is that, one, Joanna's probably not going to, and she generally doesn't, she's not going to have the stopping power in her punches to knock out Shevchenko with one or two strikes. I think that if Joanna is going to, I think the main factor in this fight is if Joanna can show that she's developed so much as an MMA fighter that she can do things that Shevchenko might not expect. Takedowns, dirty boxing, doing things that take Shevchenko out of her Muay Thai element, which the only times we've ever seen Shevchenko lose is when her opponents has been able to do that. And Joanna, I think this is a humongous chance.
I don't mean to contradict you here, but clarify. Are you talking about the Amanda Nunes' fights? Because I personally thought Shevchenko won both.
I thought Shevchenko won the second one.
Okay. I thought she clearly won the second one. Yeah. I thought she won the first one as well. But I do agree. Now, when you look at a fight like this, traditionally, the smaller fighter tends to do better than the bigger fighter, traditionally. And in this case, Shevchenko is going to be considered the bigger fighter.
Yeah.
But both of them walk around about the same. Joanna walks around right about that 135, 140, and so does Shevchenko.
I remember it was recent. Joanna just said in a recent article she had to cut traditionally around, you know, 6 kilograms to 115, which 6 kilograms, it's 2.2 pounds a kilogram, means she walked around at 125, 126 for 115. Right now, she said that she's walking about 3 kilograms, so about 131, 132, which Shevchenko probably walks around the same, considering how easy the weight cut was for her in the last fight she was scheduled to have. But there's just something about muscle built up over time and being conditioned and just leaned out that Shevchenko has been able to do due to fighting at a higher weight class. Joanna is going to have to, if she wants to match Shevchenko in the strength area, she's going to have to make up a lot of ground, which I don't know if is necessarily enough time for her to do that. I think if she's going to win, it has to be mixing it up the MMA game, not just kickboxing like she usually does, the Muay Thai, but not only doing that, but also turning her cardio up to another level and tiring out Shevchenko.
Okay, I don't question. I don't question her cardio whatsoever. Never. Okay, but one of the things I'm going to say is, do you remember when Amanda Nunes and Shevchenko was going to fight, and Amanda Nunes dropped out because she had sinusitis?
Yes.
That day, Joanna called up Dana White. She actually went to Dana White and said, I will step in and fight. And I believe it was the California State Athletics Association or the Nevada said they turned the fight down because they said it just wasn't enough time because it was going to be less than 24 hours. But Joanna was walking around at 135 then.
Yeah.
So that's another reason why I said she walks around at that 135.
Oh, Joanna's a gangster. She's down for anything.
She's a total Polish gangster. Yes, she is. So when I look at that, that's one of the things I was just kind of bringing in. There was something that, oh, and then as far as the strength factor goes, is there anyone other than Cyborg stronger than
Valentina? Amanda?
Same weight class. It's going to be fighting for the title now.
145 or 135?
One, the strawweight title.
Oh, the strawweight title. You're talking about Shevchenko.
No, just one. Just knocked out.
You're talking about Andrade.
Yes, Jessica Andrade. Is there anyone stronger than Jessica Andrade? Joanna has been in the ring with Jessica Andrade and has filled her strength.
And Gedalia.
And Claudia Gedalia. But Jessica Andrade is just, like, unreal how strong she is.
Jealous of her biceps.
Yes. And she has been able to handle, she has proven that not she can handle a bigger, stronger fighter. So that's another reason why when I look at it and I say, if Shevchenko comes in as a stronger fighter, Joanna is geared as can handle that. She can also handle the weight cut. She's all because she walks around close to that 135, so it'll be a small weight cut. I think she'll be a much faster, more nimble fighter. But it's just almost impossible to bet against Valentina Shevchenko, and it's impossible for me to bet against Joanna. That's why I'm having the toughest time with this fight. I do not know who I'm gonna take.
Honestly, on paper, I think that it's hard to argue that Shevchenko isn't at least a narrow favorite.
Tell me why. Well, because I think a lot of people are discounting Joanna because of the fights with Rose, and I think that's a bad decision.
Even without the Rose fights, okay. Rose is not the same fighter as Shevchenko. It's at a different weight class, and you know when you move up in weight, especially when you're at that low of a weight, in general, 10 pounds is a lot bigger of a difference. Mm-hmm. But with Shevchenko, just with the history of beating Joanna, and then also her being, you know, like you're talking about Andrade. Andrade is very strong and muscular for 115. However, Shevchenko has been able to go strength for strength, for the most part, with the girls at 135. And she has the right body type. Andrade, much like Tyron Woodley, they're shorter for their weight class. They have a lot more muscle in terms of proportion, which means they have to be a lot more careful with how their output is and so they don't gas out. I think you saw that with the Gedalia fight. Gedalia was putting it on Joanna Jędrzejczyk for the first two rounds.
I agree with you. Now, when you talk about, I apologize for cutting you off, but Claudia Gedalia is the ultimate, like, I think Claudia Gedalia is an amazing fighter. She's one of my favorite fighters, but Claudia has been known to gas every single time. That's what happened with her with Jessica Andrade and Joanna Jędrzejczyk. But what are you going to say? I apologize for cutting you off there.
not even Gedalia, but you just see in general fighters who are a lot more heavily muscled in proportion.
Tend to gas
just because, you know, science, more muscle means you need more oxygen to, you know, get the blood going or to, you know, carry oxygen throughout the body. But I think that Shevchenko has the type of strength where her body is proportional to the weight class she's fighting at. She's nice and tall, lean. Yes, she has some, you know, she has some good muscle, but she isn't exactly looking like a Mike Tyson there. She has good cardio, she has a good camp, and I don't see her gassing in the first three rounds of this five-round fight. I think that a lot of what Joanna hung on to, especially early in her 115 career, was the fact that, you know, when she had those five-round fights...
She definitely has the gas tank than everybody else.
Oh, you see her in the fifth round, she was going just as faster, if not faster, than the first round.
I would say, yes.
She picked up the pace.
Yes, I agree with you. That's not gonna, now, that's where we're on the same page. Valentina is not going to fade down the stretch. She is not.
No.
Now, you agree on that one?
Yeah, I agree, as long as, you know, everything in her camp goes right, no injuries.
Right, yeah, but Valentina traditionally has a pretty solid camp. She does one of the things that I've always loved about what Valentina Shevchenko does, different than every other fighter, is she does her camp like a boxer, and I think it's smart. She doesn't belong to any real camp. She goes to wherever she needs to train. She brings in the people that she wants to bring in. And she runs her camp that way like a boxer does, where most MMA fighters, it's I'm an AKA fighter and I just train at AKA. Well, I don't always think that's the best way to do things.
Oh, definitely not. And you're starting to see people begin to realize that. I mean, first of all, you look at the people who are refusing to believe in that. You see the Cody Garbrandts, which, I mean, Cody Garbrandt, great fighter. But, you know, he was calling out TJ Dillashaw saying, you switch camps, you're trying to do other things, you're a traitor.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. At the end of the day, you know, you have to live with your career. It's an individual sport, and you have to do what's best for you. So you're starting to see a lot more fighters branch out. George St. Pierre was kind of the first to do this, you know.
Right,
even
I
for
agree.
His last fight. He was going from TriStar in Canada, going to New York for John Donaher and Henner Gracie.
Exactly.
Going to L.A. for Freddie Roach to work on his boxing. And, hey, I mean, that left hook sent Michael Bisping down.
Yes.
That was well worth the time and patience.
And I think that is the smart way, and that's the next level of MMA. And I think, and Valentina has that, and I think it gives her an advantage over a lot of fighters, and that's, I think, why she's been so successful. But with that, we're going to wrap this one up. This segment, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk about that UFC Fight Night 137, we'll just talk a little bit about the card, and also talk a little bit about... Maybe a couple other things, but the main event card is what we're going to mostly talk about. A couple other things, and then what are we going to finish off with?
We're going to finish off with talking about the recap of UFC Fight Night 137, as well as, if we have some time left over, talk about recent comments made by Tyron Woodley and George St. Pierre in regards to a possible fight at 170.
Nicely done. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The average SUV has two blind spots, weighs between 4 and 6,000 pounds, and takes about 6 seconds to stop. Remember this the next time you're on foot. Pay attention, people. Pedestrians don't have armor. A message from the California Office of Traffic Safety.
All right, we're back, and Sean and I have been talking. The announcement that Joanna Jędrzejczyk and Valentina Shevchenko will be fighting for the flyweight title. Both of us are pretty psyched about that. I keep calling Joanna my spirit animal, and she is. So now we're going to talk about UFC Fight Night 137. All right, I'm going to say, when I saw this card, I was not excited, a little bit. Matter of fact, I didn't even really want to watch it, but if it wasn't for the fact that, you know, we were going to be covering it, I probably would have skipped this card. And because it was just a lot of fighters that aren't really highly ranked. But the card did not disappoint. There were some really good fights on this card. And as a whole, it turned out to be a very nice, fun card. What was your thoughts on the card?
Honestly, felt the same way as you. At times with the UFC having so many events almost every weekend now, you can feel a little bit of a oversaturation in the market. And, you know, you see a fight night where the main event, the entire main event basically fell through. You know, it was supposed to be initially, I think it was Glover versus Manoa. And then yes. Glover fell out. Then Manoa, as soon as he landed, you know, hurt his hamstring or something like that, tore something. And then now you had Thiago Santos and Eric Anders, which, you know, Thiago's been riding a bit of a hype train lately, especially yes, with absolutely. His recent wins, which well-deserved. The guy's a scary, scary-looking man, but and scarier in the cage. But, you know, I think it punched above its weight class.
Yeah, you know what? As a looking at this card and thinking this may be the worst card I have seen the UFC put out in a few years to what it actually produced, I gave this card an A+ on results, even though there may not have been, it was lacking in star power, but it actually, I think, how many fights was there total?
14?
Yeah, 14. 12 of the 14 ended in a stoppage?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot better, but the fight that really turned out to be unbelievable was that main event. The main event just really capped this card off, which was Thiago Santos versus the number 12 contender versus Eric, your boy, Anders. And Anders, who was a former Alabama, I think it was a linebacker.
Yeah.
I was excited about this. You knew these guys were going to throw bombs. But when you looked at these guys and you say, okay, these are two middleweights that are moving up to light heavyweight, but they look like heavyweights. Did they not look like heavyweights in that ring?
Oh, those are some thick and juicy boys right there.
You know, I'm going to leave that last part out.
Okay.
But they were some thick guys.
They were some thick boys with two C's.
I don't know if I feel comfortable calling any guy thick, but there were some big boys.
Those some big old boys. But, yeah, no, I mean, you see Thiago Santos, he's been riding a little bit of a hype train lately. But I think this, honestly, you know, with a lot of the controversy you hear about weight classes and weight cutting, I think this fight really just showed fighters who are fighting at their natural weight class.
These guys were definitely fighting at their natural weight class.
You got guys like, you know, the bigger middleweights like Luke Rockhold. They talk about how generally outside of, you know, fight camp, they weigh around 210, 215, like Weidman, Rockhold. If they're not getting letting themselves go, that's generally what they're at. But when these guys, which I'm sure Thiago Santos is somewhere around there, he's a big boy, I'm sure he probably is around the same. And, you know, fighting at 205, easy weight cut, probably didn't, you know, I mean, other than just getting in shape, he probably didn't have to worry about, you know, weight and diet management, just making sure his cardio was all right. Eric Anders, again.
Eric came in, he took this fight on short notice, yeah. So he didn't really have a camp.
No.
And
I think, you know, it showed, though, in the fight.
Yeah, I think at the end, the way this fight ended, which I had never seen a fight end this way, was quite crazy. And
a little disturbing.
A little disturbing, yes. What happened at the end of the fight was this was in the third round, and with about 30 seconds left, Thiago is actually hitting him with a lot of elbows, a lot of strikes. And Eric is actually, he's actually sliding on down. I thought he was trying for like a double leg, but he was actually kind of collapsing a little bit.
Yeah.
And then when the bell sounded and he turns over and he's leaning on the referee, kind of like the back of a chair. And when the referee moved, he just fell on down. Then he was trying to get across the ring. They stood him up. He collapsed again. They picked him up again. And then he collapsed again. And that's when I was a little surprised that the doctors weren't in there quicker. And the reason why that is because it kind of reminded me of when Kimbo and Data 5000 fought. When you have a situation where you have two fighters, when you have a fighter who is collapsing, you got to be worried about heart, you know, brain trauma. There should, I felt like doctors should have been in there a lot faster. What did you think about when you saw, first of all, when you saw this, and do you agree that, you feel like the doctors should have been in there a lot quicker?
I mean, doctors can only go so fast into a ring because, you know, traditionally at the end of the round, you get your cut men, you get your, you know, unless you're, it's hard for anyone to see unless you got some camera right there or you're right next to the right part of the cage, what kind of real damage they're taking. And this fight actually reminded me of a lot of, if you remember the Travis Brown versus the, pretty boy assassin or heavyweight. Josh Barnett.
Okay.
Travis Brown versus Josh Barnett, where Travis Brown, you know, he's going for that, or, you know, Josh Barnett, much like Eric Anders, was trying to get the takedown. His head was trying, he was trying to stuff his head under the crotch area of Travis Brown, as well as, you know, Eric for Thiago Santos. And this, those elbows just coming again and again. And, you know, at a certain point, it's not you going for a double leg, it's you trying to protect yourself. And, you know, he took, like, anywhere from, like, 10 to 15 elbows, just elbows.
I was going to say at least 15.
Yeah.
But even before that, remember when the referee came over and he put the mouthpiece back in?
Yes.
He was gassed then. He was absolutely gassed then.
Oh, he was. He might have, you know, not saying he did, but, you know, traditionally in boxing, there is a technique where fighters a lot of times spit out their mouthpiece if they're trying to gain 5 to 10 seconds to, you know, regain their composure. Now, in MMA, it's a little different because they, you know, you continue to fight if your mouthpiece is out until there's a good stoppage for the ref. But just having the mouth, as someone, you know, we've both competed, having no mouthpiece makes it
gives you a lot more air
to
breathe. It really does. I mean, it's because when you're winded and you're sucking air, that mouthpiece is a total, like,
Probably take in maybe 20% of the intake you could take without a mouthpiece.
Yes, I agree with you. So, but as a whole, when you look at this, eventually the fight was stopped. It was a TKO winner. Thiago Santos won. And when you look at what's next for these guys, I think Thiago should stay at light heavyweight.
I think that was the plan originally for him.
And matter of fact, I'm going to even say Eric Anders should stay at heavyweight. I mean, at light heavyweight. And let me tell you why.
Okay. Skeptical.
You look at this situation. He's now what? He's 11-1 or 11-2?
11-1.
Okay, he's now 11-1. You look at the light heavyweight division right now, off of this win, Thiago's one or two fights from a title shot.
I mean, with light heavyweight, everyone's one or two fights from a title shot.
Exactly. But if you take both of these guys and you move them down to middleweight, they are a million miles away from any major position. But they're right in it. Both of these guys have the body for light heavyweight, and it's a much easier path to getting to the top.
I don't think Eric Anders is ready for a title shot. I mean,
theoretically. It was coming off a lot. I'm just saying, theoretically, it was the best path for them.
If you wanted the shortest path to, you know, a title shot, even if you're a 155er, go to light heavyweight. You'll have to win one or two fights. But Eric Anders, he shows a lot of potential. D1 athlete, you know, got all the potential in the world. I think what's best for him is to stay at middleweight for right now, build his resume up, also just round off your skills.
You don't think you can build your resume up by fighting in the light heavyweight division?
I think that he's going to be the victim of his own success at light heavyweight because he will, with a couple of wins, he will face those people he's not quite ready yet.
And the only thing I'm going to tell you when I come with Anders is this. Yes, he did lose this fight, but he was a game fighter in this fight on a guy who had a very, very short. I think he had less than a week to prepare for this fight.
Yeah, if that.
Yeah. So the big problem was he was not in a situation where he could have a full camp at that weight. He would have performed a lot better, and he performed nicely in this fight.
He didn't do bad. I mean, other than the, where Thiago Santos really dominated was at the intermediate range where, you know, that boxing slash there's a little room for kicking. That's where Thiago really took over, but, you know.
And also, I thought cardio.
His cardio was better, but you're seeing a very big trend right now where since middleweight is so stacked, like you're saying, you're seeing a lot of people moving or considering the move to light heavyweight. I mean, you've had talk of Yoel Romero, T. Thiago Santos. Luke Rockhold's even considered a fight against Usasin. And then not only that, you have Anthony Evan Smith, another guy like Thiago Santos, who I actually think his last loss was against Thiago Santos.
Yes, it was.
Is considering light heavyweight. So very soon, you could be seeing four or five of those really high-end middleweights in light heavyweight.
Yeah, and I agree. I think the light heavyweight division needs it so bad.
Oh, it's...
I mean, really bad today.
It needs a couple... It needs a lot of things. it needs a retirement plan for half its fighters.
So, the migration of a lot of the bigger middleweights moving to an actual... their natural weight and fighting at a light heavyweight division, I think is actually a good thing.
When Shogun is, you know...
still
Shogun,
contending for
when
the
Shogun's
title.
In the top six of your light heavyweight division... Shogun, one of the greatest of all time. No disrespect. But he has taken so much damage and just, his body's just so beat up that if light heavyweight was anywhere near as competitive as most of the other divisions, he wouldn't even crack the top 15 probably.
All right. And now what you just said there, do you realize how close Shogun came to getting a title fight against Daniel Cormier?
Yeah.
Daniel even opened up and said that's the guy he wanted to fight next.
Oh, yeah. No, watching Anthony Evan Smith fight Shogun was a lot like watching my older brother beat up my dad. It was a little disturbing, kind of expected at a certain degree, but it still kind of hurt because, as someone who really appreciated those Pride days and, watched
you're
a lot of odds.
You're a big Pride guy.
I like those soccer kicks and stomps, not going to lie. But those guys beat each other up, and especially the Shogun and the Vanderlays and all them, they went into the type of camps that they sparred hard. They went hard in every sparring session, and that put on a lot of miles, even if age doesn't show it. They put on a lot of miles that could have been saved for the ring, and I think they're really starting to see the effects of that.
There's your actual age, and then there's your MMA age.
And if you're if you have 20-something fights and you're like 32 years old, you might as well be 45 in MMA.
And now I'm going to bring up another fight that took place on this card here. And that is Oliveira, Charles Oliveira. He won by rear naked choke. Wasn't it rear naked choke?
Yes, it was rear naked choke. And honestly, Charles Oliveira, I think he just broke the record.
Right,
for
that's what I'm bringing. That's what I'm bringing up. He broke Hoist Gracie's record, which has stood for almost 20 years for the most submissions. The thing that I had a little problem with is you have one of the most hallowed records there is, which is the most submissions, which is your original star.
It's like the home run record.
Right. It's your home run record. Why didn't the UFC do more about this? Why didn't they talk about this? Why didn't they have a build up that he's only, he's two submissions away from breaking the record, or he's tied the record? It was kind of and he wins, and that breaks the record for the most submissions. Okay, have a good night.
That's a problem that I think the UFC has with its marketing.
Yes.
If you want to build the brand beyond just the fighter's name, you have to have the history and the records of the history being a part of that hype. And Charles Oliveira, someone might call this sacrimony, but the fact that he was able to beat that record in this era is more impressive because, back in the day with Hoist Gracie, half the people didn't even know what a rear naked choke was. They would call it a sleeper hold or something. Yeah. But nowadays, every UFC fighter has years of jiu-jitsu under him. And, I'm sure if you have a couple of years of, if you even have a year of going three times a week to a jiu-jitsu class,
it gives you a big advantage.
It's a lot harder to get choked out. You have to be on another level if you're going to choke out a UFC caliber fighter.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're fighting someone, let's say you fight someone on the street and you take their back and you put the fish hooks in, they're looking at you. Everyone is, they're looking at you like, what the heck are you doing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but to break that record, which is a 20-year record, it should have been a bigger deal. That should have been, especially on a card that was so lacking stardom, and you're trying to figure out a way to promote this, maybe promoting that he's actually going for one of the hallowed records would be a big deal. I was disappointed that it was just part of commentary, and he now has the record for the most submissions. All right, let's move on to the main card, and have a good
one. One thing with that, I remember, and I'm a lifelong Dodgers fan. I remember when I was younger, and Barry Bonds was going after not only the single season record, but the all time home run
exactly.
record. I don't like the Giants, but everyone and their mother was watching Barry Bonds and wanting to see if that was the day he would break it. We were all watching. And not only that, but, ESPN the next morning. There was so much hype. An entire news network, sports news network, was geared around that. And now, the UFC, one of their failings is that they didn't accomplish this.
That's my point is, this was a great opportunity two fights ago, maybe three fights ago, to start building, because unless you are a hardcore fan, you have no clue who Charles Oliveira is.
Yep.
Zero. But this was a great, because he was going for this record, this was an opportunity to build his name and start to create a star just behind the fact that he's on pace to set one of the most hallowed records.
I mean, you got a good looking young Brazilian fighter who,
23-8 record.
Yeah, he's got a good record. I mean, in MMA, it's not like boxing. Everyone's going to have your losses.
Right.
So it's not going to take your stock down by any means, but he's a young fighter. He has lots of potential, and he's a beast on the ground. And at 155 right now, I think the, 155, and I'll stand by this, is the most stacked division in the UFC. And the fact that he's doing so well while, being in such a stacked division really shows that this guy has the potential to do a lot of great things.
He's only
28.
Yeah, exactly.
He's entering his prime right now.
Exactly. That's what I was getting at. UFC lost a great opportunity to start building another, because the big problem that the UFC has right now is no stars. But they have the old stars. Well, you have a 28-year-old guy who you could have been building this tagline for his last three fights, and when he breaks the record, he breaks it at 28. You got another 6, 7, 8, 10 years with this guy being a star if you just build it properly.
I mean, you look at the names that go up on that list of most submission wins. Here are the top three, because I remember looking at this a while ago.
Okay.
It's Royce Gracie, Charles Oliveira, and a little-known guy is Nick Diaz.
Oh, really?
Nate Diaz, my bad.
Nate, okay. Nate, I was going to say, what? Okay.
Nate Diaz.
Okay, that makes more sense, but yeah. I was like, wait a
my
minute.
nowadays it's Nate's brother Nick, not Nate's brother Nate. Yeah, Nate Diaz.
Yes.
So two of those three are some of the biggest stars they ever had.
Why not build this guy up?
He has a lot of potential.
Right. And so I think the UFC really lost a great opportunity to build a big name. Before we wrap this segment up, was there any other fight on this card that you wanted to talk about or anything else that you were excited about?
Yes, let's let's talk about the fight before that. Or there's two, but if we're going to stick to one, let's talk about the Little Nog fight.
Okay, Little Nog knocked out
Sam Alvey.
Yes. Okay. It was good to see Little Nog get in the win column. I thought it was a great story where he gets a knockout in his own and his and his home country of Brazil. And I have always been, it's kind of funny to say, a Nog fan. Big Nog, Little Nog, Eggnog. I have always been a fan of all three of those. But just like an eggnog, sometimes it comes to an end.
Yeah.
And
there's a season for it.
Is it time that Little Nog retires?
I mean,
this is the perfect way for him to go out as well.
I mean, I think, in my opinion, if you're in the UFC, if you're not there for, just a specific fight, everyone there is going for the belt. That is the idea of being in the toughest league in the world.
Or unless you're BJ Penn.
Unless you're BJ Penn and, bet the house.
Right.
But Little Nog, or, Nogueira, I think he should have put his gloves down then. I think a knockout win against a, you know, Sam Alvey's no random guy off the street. I mean, he's a legit UFC fighter.
Yes, he is.
Is he going to be top five in any weight division? No. Is he going to contend for the title? No. But he's a legit fighter who's a UFC veteran, and it's a good win for Little Nog, and he should have retired. And just with, you know, CTE coming out, and I mean, I don't know where Lil Nogueira lives right now. I'm assuming it's Brazil. I'm sure he's got more than enough money from being an international superstar.
And you know, I never try to talk about something to, you know, count somebody else's money.
Yeah.
But you know, you can have I've spent a lot of time in Brazil. You can have a pretty good life in Brazil.
I mean, he's probably a celebrity in Brazil. Like the Nogueira brothers, Silva. Yes. Like,
yeah. Oh, absolutely.
He could probably open his own jiu-jitsu chain up. If he hasn't already.
That part I'm not sure on. That one I can't speak on. I'm not sure on that one. Another fight, I'm gonna change the subject just a little bit, because there's another fighter that I thought that fought, and I think it's time to come on home as well. Hector Lombard.
Oh, yes.
Hector Lombard, he's 40 years old. He's not had the most successful rank.
When you look at,
how many fights have he lost?
Six.
Okay.
Six in a row.
So he's lost. He hasn't won, and it's been eight fights since he's won. He had a no contest here. He had one no contest.
Three and a half years.
Yes, he hasn't. That's what I mean. He hasn't won in 3.5 years, and he's lost six fights in a row. Haven't won in eight fights. It's time. It's kind of like, I don't know. Either he has this ironclad contract, I don't know what it is, but who else do you know can lose six, seven fights straight and still
be in the UFC?
Yes.
I mean,
did you realize that he had that many losses in a row?
Oh yeah, no. I mean, I think he's kind of become a, you know, not to be too young hip with the kids, but internet meme nowadays, where, you know, Hector Lombard, when he came to the UFC, he was one of the most hyped prospects in a long time. He was, I think he had like two, maybe three losses. And then he, you know, coming from Pride, and then, you know, when he first came against Tim Boach, that was a huge upset when Tim Boach came back to beat Hector Lombard. But he's never really gotten off with his UFC career, you know?
His record in the UFC, he's 3-8.
He's 3-8, and not to any speculation, but he's a...
Plus he lost his last two in Pride.
He's lost his... And, I mean, hey, man, Gegard Mousasi is no joke.
No joke.
He's still a contender to this day. But Hector Lombard, I think he reached a point where his body type, he looks a lot like a Husamar Paul Harris, which he did beat Husamar Paul Harris. But I think that his style and body type, that judo style and body type that he has, just isn't enough to beat the elites of the UFC nowadays.
I mean, you look at it.
He's 5'9". I mean, Tyron Woodley's 5'9" at 170, and he's still considered short for that weight.
When you look at it and you say since 2006, he's had 14 fights, and he's only won three.
Yeah.
How is he still in the UFC? That is the question that I have. I don't mean to be rude toward Hector Lombard. He had an amazing career, but it's that time.
I mean, you look at where he's from. I mean, he's from Cuba, and you know, a lot of those fighters like Yoel Romero, you hear their interviews, and quite frankly, this is what they have. I mean, they're grateful. I mean, especially if you had to, like, you know, move to America under, you know, circumstances that weren't exactly favorable for the Cuban government. There's a lot that he has to lose if he probably doesn't have this job. It's not like he I don't want to say desperate as much as it's who he is. And I think that, like a lot of other pro sports, people who've been fighting their whole lives don't know what to do with themselves if they retire. And then you have that, plus the possible CT. I mean, the Dan Henderson fight alone is one of the scariest knockouts I think I've ever seen.
Yes, I know exactly the back fist that hit him, yes.
Oh, geez, that head kick. I mean, I didn't even know Dan Henderson could get his leg that high, you know, with his, like, you know, just being that old. But then with the backwards elbow into the Oh, right yes. into the temple? Not pretty.
Another guy, Henan Barao.
Oof, yeah.
Henan Barao, when you look at... This is the reason why I wasn't excited about this. Since losing his title to TJ Dillashaw in 2015, July 25th, 2015, he has only won one fight.
You know... 2014.
No, sorry. Sorry, you're right. And 24, he lost it to T.J. Dillashaw and, wait a minute, is that correct?
Yeah, 2014, yeah.
Yeah, T.J. Dillashaw, yeah, he lost it in 2014. He's won two fights. He's won two fights since 2014.
I remember that, and honestly, I think Henan Barao kind of fell into that bad area of the UFC where, you know, him, much like Jose Aldo, that came from the same camp, he was 35-1 at one point.
Yes.
I think that he kind of fell victim to the fact that he is now someone for other up-and-comers to build their name off of. That, you know, when he was beating up Uriah Faber, when he was, you know, beating up all of Team Alpha Male and, you know, all the other lightweight people in the UFC from America, he was doing great. But I think that his style eventually, you know, got caught. When people are studying you, they figure out how to beat your style. And when TJ Dillashaw beat him for the first time, that is perhaps one of the, maybe the most masterful performance I've ever seen inside the octagon of a fighter not only coming together as a fighter, but as a coach and a fighter coming together as a team, just laying out the blueprint. And I think that really put in a new era for that division. And I don't want to say, and I don't throw that term around lightly, because, you know, you had Dominic Cruz and whatnot.
But it also changed his career.
Oh, it changed his career. And I think that Henan Barao is just not what he used to be. It's hard for him to make the weight. He's gotten older. And, you know, with people's, you know, with kidneys especially, it's harder for people to cut that much water weight. I don't know what his financial situation is, but if he can retire, I think it's a good time to enjoy a little more time with the kids and maybe open up a gym.
You know what? This is the perfect moment for us to retire. We're gonna call it a show here. Once again, thank you for tuning in and listening to the GSMC MMA podcast. Once again, I'm your host, Tate, and my co-host, my new and improved co-host, Will's still around, and he's still great as well, but my new co-host is going to be joining us as well. Sean, here, you did a great job.
Thank you.
And you'll see a lot more of Sean in the next coming weeks, and also Will will be coming in as well. But with that, to all, have a good night.
You've been listening to the Golden State Media Concepts MMA Podcast. Part of the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. You can find this show and others like it at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Download our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Just type in GSMC to find all the shows from the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. From movies to music, from sports to entertainment, and even weird news. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. Thank you, and we hope you have enjoyed today's program.